Well, thank you very much for including me, Dana. It's been really interesting learning another viewpoint of the Middle East the last couple of days. When I was at university, my professor told me that I should go and learn German if I really wanted to understand the Orient. I actually spent 4 months in Germany, including 2 months as a Gastarbeiter in a Munich hotel. I didn't meet many Germans, but I did learn some German, at least enough to follow your really interesting discussions. And my tutor was right. I have learned a lot listening to you. Yes, Werner and I were colleagues in Istanbul for many years. But in the Iraq War in 2003, I was the reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who was in Baghdad trying to explain to the American people what it was all about, why this war was happening, and trying to explain why it shouldn't happen, giving all the reasons I could think of. The Christians will be killed or driven out. Without the Ba'ath Party, you cannot run the country. You will have all these problems that we've still had, but it made no difference at all.
The Wall Street Journal was in favor.
The Wall Street Journal indeed led the charge to create the momentum for the war. And I realized that being just a journalist on the news pages was no competition to the great other journalists who were appearing on the opinion pages, men of letters such as Ariel Sharon, Benjamin Netanyahu, Sharansky, and the regular drumbeat of warmongers who thought that possibly, let's give them the benefit of the doubt, perhaps they thought that getting rid of Saddam Hussein was getting rid of a bad guy, and so that would be good. This is the kind of false logic that never works in the Middle East. Anyway, after that experience, I went on for another year, but I couldn't carry on. After 25 years, I left journalism and was very, very lucky to join International Crisis Group, which, to put it shortly, was, for me, everything that journalism never was. In the International Crisis Group, we have full license to write as much as we like, at any length, nearly, that we like, with the pure aim of informing rather than entertaining. We do all our entertaining on our feet. Anyway, International Crisis Group was founded in 1995 by a British and an American diplomat who had the idea for such a group while flying out of Sarajevo and wondering why it was that the world did not foresee conflicts coming. And they had this idea in 1993, and in the meantime, they also, as they were exploring building up this organization, Rwanda happened, Somalia happened. And so when in January 1995, a group of about 35, 40 people from all over the world met to discuss whether this group should be set up, it was seemed very clear that a new international organization was needed. Not a humanitarian organization, but an organization that would intervene with policymakers to try and give alert policymakers to wars about to happen and what they could do to avoid them, and also what could be done about ongoing conflicts to reduce their potency, and when you have peace processes, how to make them work. And from a tiny beginning, largely underwritten by George Soros and by a number of Nordic governments,
and Switzerland.
And Switzerland came on a little later, but Switzerland remains today one of our most loyal and important partners and funders, yes. We have grown now to a group of about 130 people of 50 different nationalities and mother languages. And we work on about 50 to 60 conflicts around the world. We are based mostly in the field as much as we can. The idea, the mission statement is the prevention of deadly conflict. The methodology is writing pretty long reports, 20 to 40 pages long, hundreds of footnotes. These reports are read by not many people, I have to admit. But the discipline of creating these reports, we normally talk to about 50 to 100 people, usually quite high level, and from all parties to a conflict. The discipline of doing all that creates an expertise in the analyst that is very rare. Most diplomats, they're just talking to one side and reporting to headquarters. We have a reporting to all the sides, and not just for an official period of a few years and then going to another job. I've lived in Istanbul for 27 years. I've worked for 7 years with the crisis group. As Verna has kindly pointed out, I am fit for no other employment now. I guess most of us are like that. Most of us have long experience in other professions before we come in.
The question is, do they listen to you? Do they read the decision makers?
I hope I will not be contradicted by the journalists in the audience, but I think that when a journalist comes to a new conflict, one of the first things he will or she will do is pick up one of our reports and read it from cover to cover.
But I just want to underline, for example, in Moscow, and the Moscow-based correspondent, Yekaterina
Sokaryanskaya,
she's an excellent also expert of the International Crisis Group, and this International Crisis Group made two very important reports about Pakistan and so on, and I very would like to recommend you to to read that. I think you will find that in the internet. It's really, and every journalist who is going to Pakistan, for example, I suppose he will read his reports from
it. It's sort of it's
excellent.
It's really sort of a secret service for everybody.
Let's call it a private foreign office. But because all the work we do is completely public, anyone around this table can download everything we do on thecrisisgroup.org.
This was actually the reason that I invited you, not because I know him, because I know a lot more people I wouldn't invite him, but I would wanted to invite you, because this is something which gives something more than the everyday lectures in the newspapers and the television. And that's exactly what during our conferences from the very beginning always was asked. Where can we get more information? So now, recently you have been reporting on this interesting tension between Turkey and Syria. Could you give an idea about what this report is about?
You're all looking at the Middle East here. I too have my origins in the Middle East. I was with Michael Braze in Damascus in 1982, studying Arabic together. It's the first time we meet since then, 32 years ago. And the one country which has been sometimes mentioned in passing, but I think is actually very important for the Middle East, is Turkey. If you look at the Middle East, it's basically a triangle. There's the Arab side, the Iranian, Persian side, and the Turkish side. And the Turkish side is very important. Turkey is the biggest economy of the region by far. It actually amounts sometimes in a good year to, I think, half of the whole of MENA, the 22 countries of the Middle East and North Africa. It has legendarily the strongest army. It is it has a large population of nearly 80 million people. It has the most advanced industry. It is said that three-quarters of Middle Eastern homes have a product made in Turkey there. The soft power of Turkey has been rising in recent years with the production of films, and a bit like Egypt in the 1950s, perhaps, when its films became famous throughout the Middle East. It is now the Turkish soap operas, which are being watched not just in the Arab world, but in the Balkans, in Central Asia, in much of this geography. They are making Turkey into a prime, I hesitate to say model, but definitely a pole of attraction. And Istanbul as a city is now completely buzzing as a hub, as it has been growing into that role ever since the end of the Cold War, which dropped all the artificial barriers that had hemmed Turkey in for many years. And one special thing marks Turkey out from the other Middle Eastern countries with which it shared most of its history up until now is that for the last 50 years, and arguably 200 years, Turkey has been in a kind of process with Europe. And in the last 10 years, specifically, has had negotiations to join the European Union. This makes it completely different from the other states of the Middle East, which are either rather autarkic and lonely, it makes Turkey look as though it is on a path to somewhere safe, and it is also obviously a member of NATO as well. So it has a very specific identity. And I raise this because what's happened over the last 3 years of the Syrian crisis, which we've just heard about, is that Turkey has found itself being dragged back into the Middle East. The European Union and other European countries have been cold towards Turkey in its accession process. Turkey itself has failed to do its homework. It is not doing the reforms that it would be required to do to actually become a member of the European Union. Turkey doesn't actually want secretly to become a member of the European Union. It's very like Britain. It's very ambivalent. But the process is very important to it, but it is losing that. And one of the reasons it's losing what's happening in Syria. When the crisis in Syria started, Turkey tried to do what International Crisis Group would have wanted to advise it to do: try and get a peaceful transition. It reached out to Bashar al-Assad and his government repeatedly over a period of months to try and persuade them to bring in Muslim Brothers into the cabinet, to show some understanding that if Syria was going to survive as it was, it would have to change. And the Syrian government pretended to listen, but as time went on, it became clear to the Turkish authorities that Bashar al-Assad was actually double-crossing them, and in fact openly double-crossed them. And at that point, the leader of Turkey, who's a rather emotional man, and basically a big bully as well, thought that he'd been double-crossed. And so he got really angry, literally angry. He's a very angry man, the Prime Minister of Turkey. And he flipped in almost overnight to a position of, okay then, you don't want to change? Well, you are going to break. We are having a policy now where Bashar is no longer going to be the president of Syria, and we are going to back all efforts to remove him. Now, there were three reasons that Turkey did that. One was a vengefulness, an emotional, you don't want to do it my way, I'm going to force you to. The second one was what happened in Libya and Egypt. Turkey was a little bit late on Libya and got left out of what it saw as a big change. And Turkey has huge commercial interests in Libya, and these were greatly put at risk by the fact that it was blindsided by Britain and France rushing into the war, whereas Turkey was trying to get, again, a negotiated transition, which, in hindsight, was probably a good idea. But it didn't happen that way. Certainly it was crisis groups that suggested the policy. And being left out of that development, to call, right, on Syria, I'm going to be in front. And the third thing, which was very important, and it was a delusion of Turkey, when, again, proving that most countries and people tend to think that other people are just like they are, they thought that because 70% of the Syrian population is Sunni Muslim, therefore, when this Alawite regime leaves Syria, the minority of Bashar al-Assad, then, of course, the natural majority of Syria will take over, and hey, we're Sunni Muslims, so our relationship with Syria will be even better, and in fact, we will control developments in Syria, and this will be an extension of Turkey's sphere of influence and power. This proved, all these things proved wrong. Bashar al-Assad has stayed on, as we've heard. At crisis group, we see no chance that he is going to lose power now. We also see no chance, as Michael said, that he is going to re-establish a Syrian state. It's going to be years of this war carrying on. It's not Turkey's fault. And in a way, it's not Turkey's fault that they got so much involved, because part of what happened with Prime Minister Erdogan's policy of bringing down Bashar al-Assad was to back the opposition in some measure. We don't know exactly the details, but it's clear from the secret conversations that have been leaked that Turkey allowed at least 2,000 trucks of its own equipment to reach rebels of some kind, that they sent a general in to train some of the opposition, and they believed they were doing this with the backing of the West. The United States has an interesting relationship with Turkey that is mostly conducted at night with
planes that arrived from Washington with the CIA director or the Pentagon director, and they do secret deals with Turkey, and that's what Turkey is for in American eyes. And one of the things that Turkey was promised was that we are behind you if you start really acting to remove Bashar al-Assad. And was when the chemical warheads were used in Syria, and again, there was a report by Seymour Hersh that it was Turkey that somehow arranged this. As far as we can tell in crisis group, this is nonsense. This was certainly the elements in the regime. We don't think it was Bashar al-Assad himself, but anyway, we think that elements in the regime definitely used these weapons. Turkey was convinced that this was the moment that America and the West was going to intervene. And indeed, Britain and France had plans to do so. And I think it was going to happen on a Monday, and on the Saturday, a phone call came to Turkey saying, sorry, we're not going to do it. Obama backed off, Britain backed off, France backed off in the end. And Turkey was left with the situation I'm going to describe to you now. Turkey, now 3 years later, it has basically discovered that it's boxed in. It has very little freedom of maneuver. It's not just that the West has stopped supporting its forward policy in Syria, but you have to remember that Turkey, as a member of NATO, cannot actually attack Syria and maintain its NATO guarantee against being attacked by someone else. It would have to be attacked by Syria, and that's quite unlikely. It has 3 Patriot missile batteries from Germany, Holland, and the United States on the border, but there's no way that Turkey will ever do anything that will put these at risk. On the other hand, its army is hardly, even though it's supposed to be the second biggest army in NATO, it is hardly able to defeat its own domestic Kurdish insurgency. One of the side effects of the Syrian crisis has been to strengthen the PKK, that domestic insurgency, meaning that Turkey has, again, less freedom of movement in what it can do. And one of the results of what Michael was describing, of this flow of jihadis across the border, which Turkey did turn a blind eye to, and I could make some justificatory remarks about that, is that that the border is now porous. It is out of control, in fact. And I will read you a transcript from a secret meeting that was released, Turkey being a sort of strange half-open, half-closed country. We actually know what they said to each other. Talking about Turkey's inability to change its policy now is that if it was to crack down on the jihadis, the head of intelligence said in this meeting, the second after this crackdown happens, it'll cause great internal commotion. And he said, the border is not under control. And he's quite right, the border is not under control. And then the head of the foreign ministry says, yes, the bombings are then, of course, going to happen. And that would probably happen in Istanbul, the touristic heart of Turkey. Now, going back to the justification of why Turkey allowed these people to come through. As I said, Turkey is trying to play in a different playing field than the rest of the Middle East. It is trying to play according to European norms. It's not doing very well, but it's doing better than any of them. And in order to stop those jihadis, Turkey would have to conduct major internal police changes to catch them. So it has a choice. As Turkey, I'm going to stop those jihadis coming through. Okay, so the first plane, you take all the guys with beards off, and you take them off to jail, and then you contact the Albanian embassy, the German embassy, the Swiss embassy, by the way, there's Swiss jihadis too, and you ask them to take back. And then the Swiss embassy says, but we have no evidence, and then you get into a long problem. So, and then, of course, the second plane that comes through, all the jihadis know, so they will have shaved their beards off, and they will have taken a normal Turkish tourist plane to Antalya, and then the bus to the border. And then the Secret Service will definitely have no control. Turkey cannot turn itself back into a police state, and it doesn't want to. And certainly it doesn't want to without the support of the European states behind it. And by the way, the European states are very niggardly. They're not very generous in their support to Turkey because for lots of reasons to do with the way Turkey usually behaves as an isolated unit. It's not very good at sharing information, and as a result, it doesn't get much information itself. Now, just turning to the Turkey-Syria border situation, which we just released a report on. You can find it on our website. This is the Turkish-Syria border. 911 kilometers, Turkey's longest land border. It used to be a Cold War border and pretty tightly managed, but right now it is so broken that in some of the border points you have an official border point where the passports are stamped, and then 20 meters along you have an opening in the wire where people can just walk through. And nobody is doing anything about it because everybody knows if you block that thing 20 meters away, it'll open up again 1 kilometer away. Obviously, a disaster in Syria. Half of the population has had to leave its homes. 1 million in Jordan, 1 million in Lebanon, and 1 million people have come to Turkey. A huge amount of people for anyone to deal with. Not just 1 million in Turkey. It's officially 720,000, but we believe it to be 1 million, and the official predictions are that it will be 1.5 million by the end of this year. There's also, in several places along the border, between 100,000 and 200,000 Syrians who are being kept on this side of the border by the Turkish authorities. They're people without paperwork, and so it's the problem is even bigger than it initially seems. It's the humanitarian emergency I will come to in a bit, but it's also a security problem. Since September 2012, we at Crisis Group, we've counted 75 Turks killed on the border. I mean, you imagine what that would mean in Switzerland. I mean, there was a huge bomb in May last year in Reyhanlı, 53 people killed, Turkey's biggest terrorist attack in the last century. Way over here, there was, three jihadis, including the Swiss guy, attacked a police roadblock, killed four Turks in just a normal street. Quite often there's shells and mortars landing on both sides. Overall, the situation that I described to you earlier is Turkey got into this as an emergency response and thought it would all be over very quickly. Turkey is stuck with the emergency response mode, and it's going to go on for another decade, and it's going to have to deal with all these people. And it's been doing it practically on its own. The world has done extremely little to help. And let me just carry on, if I can have the next photo. So this is the typical refugee response we've had. This is a Turkish camp paid for entirely by Turkey in the mountains of Hatay province, and a camp with maybe 10,000 people in it. These are some of the best refugee camps anybody has ever built anywhere in the world. You can see all the UN and other literature. And what we at Crisis Group, yes, we can go through them. You can see here's the inside of a tent, another camp. As you can see, pretty well constructed. These are, they have proper streets, latrines, and next picture. This tent is simply amazing. It has a little fountain here. They brought their pet doves from Damascus. There's a little budgerigar, a little garden in the making, and two jihadi fighters waiting for their time to go to the front. And next photo. And here's typically well-built sort of place. Not the kind of refugee camp pictures we're used to. So a very high level of support from Turkey. And a clinic for these frightened Syrian people who 75% of the refugees are women and children, by the way.
Visa.
Yes. This is something that the world has done to try and help a bit. It's a new way, obviously only possible in fairly sophisticated countries, but a chip refugee card. So there's money loaded onto this every month for every family. You know, about 15 euros per fortnight for every 2 weeks, and everybody can then go shopping with this card. Of course, everyone being a natural banker, you can also get cash if you discount it 10%. And these ladies, menfolk were all fighting in Syria, and in the meantime, they were able to support themselves. About a third of the money for this coming from the United States, the European Union giving other money, and international donors are able to do this. Now, what's interesting, if you just leave it there for the time being, What's interesting about this aid effort is, as I said, most of it is coming from Turkey. Turkey has so far spent $3 billion looking after these refugees. The outside world has given $183 million. Even the official UN Emergency Assistance Program, which is done by the UN according to emergency criteria, valid all over the world, whereas in Jordan and Lebanon, these were funded up to 70%. In Turkey, the international community only gave 38% of the funding there. It's also, obviously, when it comes to the actual people, you get a big difference as well. Turkey is looking after 1 million people. The EU is discussing whether, in its great generosity, it might not accept 30,000 people. Okay. Actually, there are about 58,000 applications for asylum in Europe currently, but the official number that is being discussed is 30,000. To be fair, Germany is the most generous of the European countries by far. It's offering to take 11,000 Syrian refugees. But the situation is very bleak for the refugees. Most of them, by the way, do not want to go to Europe. They think that the war is going to end soon and that they will be going back to their homes. But many are trying to get to Europe. And we have counted a crisis group about 150 people who have died since the last year and a half drowning in the Aegean Sea. That's just the people we know of who have died trying to make it to the promised land of Europe. Another thing that we are suggesting in our new report for the outside world to help is to try and deal with the most pressing need for most of the 500 to 800,000 Syrians who are not in the camps in Turkey. In the camps there are about 220,000 people and all the rest are outside, and most of them are living squashed into apartments. And this is very uncomfortable and it's really not sustainable. And so we're suggesting that there should be a scheme of housing credits or coupons given to the refugees that could be cashed in favor of housing stock created by the government. We developed this in together with the World Bank representation in Turkey. It's only a very new report, so we'll see whether it gets anywhere. Typically, in my experience, our crisis group recommendations take 2 or 3 years to get any kind of momentum, but if we say it in every meeting, we always feel that we're pushing the rock a little bit further up the hill. The next picture. So this is a camp school. About 60% of the children in the camps get to go to schools. This is not a propaganda camp. All the camps are this well equipped by Turkey at great expense to show how well it was looking after its Syrian guests. I would just say that there is a political subtext, is that Turkey did not want to physically support the rebels, but all these families in the camps have menfolk fighting. So in a way, this was in-kind support. The rebel could go, or the opposition fighter could go to the front in Syria knowing that his family was being well looked after. This is Turkey's way of doing that. But, you know, this is a Turkish teacher who's been drafted in to teach these Syrians. It's not working very well. I mean, these guys are still working from Syrian textbooks with Bashar al-Assad in them. On the other hand, they could be studying Turkish textbooks, but of course they don't speak Turkish. And they don't want to learn Turkish because they think they're going back to Syria. We might know that they're not going back to Syria anytime soon, but they don't know that yet. And unfortunately, outside the camps, 60% of children in Syria are not getting schooling of any kind. And even those that are going to kind of unofficial schools are not getting certificates that anybody's going to accept. So we're trying to say to the government, you must formalize this. You must accept that foreign NGOs come in and help build schools, and we're seeing how far we'll get to that. Sometimes the Syrians find a happy ending in Turkey. Like this gentleman has managed to find himself a falafel joint in a border town, and he's subletting it from a Turkish restaurateur. And many Syrian businesses, they're very creative people, the Syrians, and many of them are finding a way to make things work. In fact, the Syrians in Turkey are kind of becoming a new working class. I have a house in the south of Turkey where in the local market town, the Syrians are now the wheelbarrow people at the local wholesale fruit market. They are the sweeping the floor at the hardware store. They're building the greenhouses. They're doing all kinds of work because, funnily enough, the old Ba'athist regime did educate Syrians to a level which, I know it sounds surprising, but it's often competitive in the Turkish market. But not everybody does well. I was really shocked to come across this family in Gezi Park, in Taksim Square in Istanbul a few months ago. And I asked him, you know, what he was doing, and he said he was sleeping under a tree there. They've completely run out of money, and that is happening increasingly. The Syrian diaspora and the Syrian inventiveness has managed to keep themselves afloat for quite a long time, but some of them just fall to the bottom. And there's now 120,000 Syrians in Istanbul. No one knows what's going to happen for them. Turkey's trying to deal with it, but it's going to be a wait as Turkey goes forward. The next one. So what, you know, on the sort of bigger picture, what can be done? Given the fact that the nation-state system, which we discussed earlier, as expressed in the United Nations, is not allowing any UN aid or international aid to go across the border to the opposition-controlled areas. Yeah, there's an exception. Last month, in March, one of the borders opened up to a small area, but up till now, that was only because the Damascus regime said it was possible. So what's happening is that Turkey is allowing people like these two people that I met in the mountains, again in Hatay. These are a Syrian expatriate businessman who got together some money, hired a big truck, put in self-raising flour to make bread, and they were driving it to just the border fence where they had arranged for people to pick it up with vehicles on the Syrian side. It's called zero-point delivery, and it's been quite successful in getting goods to the millions of people in Syria who have very little to eat. And an entrepreneurial, ad hoc, unregulated, we think maybe $250 million worth of goods have gone over so far, but given the circumstances of the international order, it's about all that can be done. The next picture, please. And this is a typical picture of the actual border post. You wouldn't expect this, would you? I mean, it's a war zone on the other side, controlled by Islamic hardliners of the nth degree. And yet, most of these people are traders, taking stuff in. Many of these cars are being bought second-hand from Europe and being exported to Syria. And commercial life goes on. But the problem is that amongst these trucks, of course, there is military supplies as well. There's no division. And about a month after I took this photo, just behind there, a huge car bomb went off from the regime and killed a dozen people at least. But 2 days later, it was open again, working. The resilience of these countries has to be seen to be believed. Go on. I've talked about this is an atmospheric picture to show. This is a local shop on the border area is now selling uniforms and flags to the Free Syrian opposition. And the next picture. Okay, so this is in another camp, and these are the refugees. I was with an EU delegation, and they all went in to see the clinic, and I saw this guy with a beard. I thought I'll have a chat with him and see what. I said, "So off to the front, boys." Then, and they said, "Yeah, it's great." They have a system in the jihadi battalions where you get 28 days on of fighting and 3 days off to see your family. You leave your gun at the border, you come over to see your family, and you go back. And people get organized. It's interesting. But as a last picture to leave you with, the parameters that I was talking about that Turkey faces, which means there's very little it can do to change its policies, is that one of the unfortunate side effects of Erdogan, our prime minister in Turkey, going for it and seeking the ouster of President Assad is that he has, for the first time in my memory of Turkish history, adopted a Sunni Muslim rhetoric. And it's very, very noticeable to everybody. And in a way, he's got involved in a game that he does not understand. It involves Qatar, it involves Saudi Arabia. It makes, as I said, it's bringing Turkey into a Middle Eastern environment that it no longer really understands. And it's getting drawn in on the side of things which has an impact when you come into the east of Turkey, you know, or Turkey as a whole. Because, yes, Turkey, as I tried to say, its face is towards Europe. Turkey is a Europeanizing or modernizing country. And it really is, but it has a Middle Eastern soul, it has Middle Eastern characteristics, and it has Middle Eastern sectarian and ethnic overflows. And one of those overflows from the Middle East is the Alawis, or the Alawites, as they're called in Turkey. And this is an Alawite shrine, very close to the Syrian border, and an Alawi is paying respect to it. And these people are getting very, very nervous and upset at the way that the AK Party government of Mr. Erdogan is becoming so Sunni, because they feel completely excluded by that. A bit the same way as the old Turkish ideology of the previous governments excluded the Kurds, who ironically are now more included than they ever have been. But the problem is that as the Syrian crisis goes on, all these sectarian and ethnic fault lines are becoming increasingly big headache for Turkey, and it's going to hold it back. And I'll just leave you with one thought that I had in my last meetings in Ankara, where I was talking to the head of a pro-government think tank, and he said, you know, Hugh, I think that sooner or later we are going to have to deal with this area over our border. You know, we've talked about the Somaliaization of the Middle East, we've talked about how this the nation state is under threat, and they feel that in Ankara, and they feel that they're increasingly faced with the choice of defend our borders and damn the Middle East to whatever perdition it is choosing for itself, or deal with it. And he said that, you know, I think the day will come when we just go to Damascus and say, okay, we've had our differences, but let's go and clean up northern Syria now.
Thank you very much.